I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Historian Mia Bay writes in her new book, Traveling Black, American identity has long been defined by mobility and freedom of the open road, but African Americans have never fully shared that freedom. She traces the early days of common carriers and documents how Black passengers were forced to ride on the roofs of stagecoaches, the decks of steamships, in dangerous and filthy Jim Crow cars, in the backs of buses, and in designated seats on airplanes, all to segregate them from white passengers to prevent human contact between the races. Restrooms and restaurants were off limits to Blacks, which made travel even more degrading and difficult. Mia Bay joins us on Radio Times to tell us this little-told history of civil rights about the activists who fought for equality on the road through protest and defiance of the laws and through the courts. Mia Bay is the Roy F. and Jeanette P. Nichols Professor of American History at the University of Pennsylvania. Joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Let's begin where your book begins, and this is with Joseph K. Bowler. He's a minister. This is the 1920s, and he's got something he calls his Jim Crow traveling kit. What is in this kit?
His kit consists of a pair of overalls, a little scrub board, canned salmon, a miniature stove, and it's designed to make it possible for him to eat and clean and cook while traveling in the Jim Crow car, because the dining cars, as he told people, were sort of off limits to African Americans at that time. So he had to have everything he needed. He also wanted to keep his good clothes clean, because the Jim Crow cars sometimes even had animals in them, and they were often the smoking car where people not only smoked but consumed chewing tobacco. So he just had to keep all his ministerial finery clean.
To keep clean so that he didn't get dirty in the Jim Crow car, which, as you write, was also called at times the pauper car, the dirt car, the refuse car, the immigrant car.
Yeah, it originated as a car that rode directly behind the engine and often was used to carry junk, but it was also originally kind of a second or third class car that was, you know, that you would ride if you couldn't afford a real seat.
Well, and it was, over time, it was made out of wood. So if there was an actual train accident and you were right behind the engine in a wooden train car.
Yeah, that was one of the many problems with Jim Crow. As railroad technology developed and they made all metal passenger cars, they kept the wooden cars and used them for the Jim Crow cars, which was always kind of the worst car on the train. And when you got to the point where you had an all-metal engine, all-metal passenger cars, and a wooden Jim Crow car riding between those things, you had a series of train crashes over the turn of the century up to, I think the last one was in 1951, where the majority of the wounded and the dead were people in the Jim Crow car.
Why did you start with Jim Crow? I mean, I can understand why you would start a book like this with the Jim Crow car, but you said it really was just hated, and understandably so.
Yeah, I mean, the Jim Crow car was what sort of drew my attention to the segregated transportation, because there's barely anyone who ever sort of was any kind of Black leader or wrote about Black life that didn't talk about how much they hated the Jim Crow car. And many of them also kind of presented the Jim Crow car as a metaphor for the ways in which Blacks were made into second-class citizens.
In fact, you wrote a book about Ida B. Wells, and she was thrown off, I guess, this is where it gets complicated, right? The ladies' car.
Yeah. And
tried to get some kind of justice. But what happened with her?
Yeah, this is what actually sort of one of the things that got me interested in this book is that I hadn't really thought about how segregation originated, but up till the late 19th century, there was these gender divisions. Railroads tried to get women to ride the railroads by providing them these non-smoking cars with more comfortable seats, sort of more first-class accommodations. And initially, that was the main distinction. So Ida B. Wells was a young Black journalist in the 1880s, and she was traveling to work by train. And she rode in a ladies' car, but then one day she got kicked out of the ladies' car. And this reflected the fact that this is at the early 1880s in Tennessee, and they're moving towards segregation. And it's not established yet. So she sues and wins in the lower court and then loses in the upper court. And it for her, this is what makes her into an activist. This gets her going. She writes her first journalistic piece about it. And, you know, it's something she remains passionate about.
Well, and as you write, these laws in many ways were so patchwork. I mean, depending from state to state, these segregation laws when it came to public transit, and that respectable women of color could be allowed on the women's car, but they had to meet whatever that criteria was.
Well, that was one of the reasons why the ladies' car thing was ultimately replaced by the colored cars, because when the respectable women of color, like Ida B. Wells-Sues, sometimes they won, you know, so because there was no really defensible way to say that you couldn't, black women couldn't ride in the ladies' car, though they tried to say they were prostitutes or, you know, just being a nuisance, which is what they would said in the case of Ida B. Wells. But they won a fair amount of time. So that was one of the things that pushed the states to adopt what were called separate car laws, which were by race rather than gender.
And this gets us to Plessy v. Ferguson, right?
Yes, exactly.
And he was this was something a group, I guess, in New Orleans really sort of tried to defy some of these laws by him taking a seat in the white section of a train and refusing to get off.
Yeah, no, Plessy was one of a series of challenges by black litigants to the separate car laws. It became the most famous one because it goes to the Supreme Court and it produces this things can be separate but equal verdict. You know, it's by then it's actually segregation is sort of a done deal. It's sort of more common than not, and this is a challenge to it that fails. But it's not the last challenge, because one of the things that people don't notice about Plessy is that within the text itself, the justices specify that it's only applies to transportation within the state of Louisiana. It's not an interstate law, because interstate commerce is not under the Supreme Court's jurisdiction.
Which some of these legal complications, but this idea of separate but equal was never true.
No, it was never. It was never true. It was actually kind of the opposite. But it became this kind of metaphor, because the railroads initially opposed separate car laws because they were afraid they'd have to actually provide separate but equal accommodations, which would have cost them an enormous amount of money. But once they realized that the courts would just turn a blind eye to actual differences, then they sort of began to just use the oldest, dirtiest cars, the Jim Crow car, and put luggage and smokers and animals or whatever else they needed to in it.
Well, and it's interesting to think. So obviously, as slavery ends, mm-hmm. then you've got emancipation, and then you've got this "quote unquote" problem of how mm-hmm. to keep the races separate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it becomes a problem precisely because, you know, when you're traveling, you're you know, sort of the racial hierarchy is not clearly determined. A lot of travel things are trying to create kind of a domestic space, like a drawing room at that time. And one thing they do not want to have in it is black people, especially in the sort of first class accommodations that are beginning to develop.
So this is, I mean, it seemed like that there were, this was in the North and in the South, we should say.
This was in the North and the South, and it reflected anxieties about actually the possibility of racial equality. One of the groups that is most unwelcome, you know, are actually middle class, well-dressed middle class black people who can afford tickets because they make, you know, they make whites who aren't competing in this way feel bad. They're not a normal presence in middle class homes, so they create real alarm in both the North and the South.
But it is interesting. We have this idea that in America, and maybe this is, well, I think it's probably certainly more true for white people than for mm-hmm. black people, which is freedom of the road, the ability to get into some form of transportation and take off and go somewhere and explore, you know, explore the West or whatever.
Yeah, that's one thing I just found consistently in this book to be, it was just never true for black people. I mean, you had the Jim Crow car kit on the train. Drivers would load up their cars with all the food they planned to eat, sometimes bottles to pee in, sometimes even gasoline because they were worried about being able to stop to eat. They would sometimes plan to sleep in the car. They'd plan to sleep at night. People had to, or if people wanted to stay in a hotel, they had to sort of write and ask or call people to try to find out where there would be hotels or other kinds of accommodations that would take African Americans. So I think for African Americans, that freedom has been rarely true. Even today, people sort of worry about racial profiling and, you know, places that aren't pleasant.
But as you say in this book, segregation was never systematic. It was sort of in fits and starts, which I assume would make it even more difficult if you're in a different county or a different state. Like, what are the laws? How do they apply to me?
Yeah, that was, I mean, many African Americans reported that the North in certain ways was worse because you just had no idea, like, which restaurant would allow you to sit and eat and which wouldn't. But even in the South, the actual specific rules varied from place to place. So you could end up breaking segregation rules without even planning to, which I think is one of the reasons why it made people so furious, because it was, you know, like nobody could entirely, it was a system you couldn't really follow.
And there were trains, I guess once they hit us, was it Baltimore, maybe Washington, D.C., where you'd have to change the configuration because you're going into the Deep South.
Yes, exactly. But that was another thing that also irked people, because on some trains, they would start moving people into the Jim Crow car as far north as Chicago or New York. Or, and in one case, Langston Hughes talked about being in a Jim Crow car that he got on in Los Angeles and going to Louisiana, and they put him in the Jim Crow car out of Los Angeles. So that was another example of people didn't necessarily follow the rules or the law the way they did Jim Crow.
And how long did we have Jim Crow cars on trains in this country?
Between the 1880s and the 90s, they really don't end until 1960.
Until 1960.
1961 with the Freedom Rides, really.
That the Freedom Rides were the sort of in defiance of some of these laws, really.
The Freedom Rides pushed the Kennedy administration to both have the Interstate Commerce Commission issue a very clear order that this was illegal on interstate transportation, and then also use the Justice Department to enforce it. And that was sort of the point where you really no longer have any Jim Crow cars.
And in real life, I mean, and that really truly put an end to these Jim Crow cars?
It put an end to Jim Crow cars, yes.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Mia Bay is our guest on Radio Times today. She's the Roy F. and Jeanette P. Nichols Professor of American History at the University of Pennsylvania. She's written several other books, To Tell the Truth Freely, The Life of Ida B. Wells, and we mentioned her. Also, The White Image of the Black Mind, Freedom on My Mind, A History of African Americans with Documents. And her newest book is called Traveling Black, A Story of Race and Resistance. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We want you to join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, especially if this story is one that is familiar to you from your own experience. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. In with the development of mass transit after emancipation, Black Americans hope for mobility and freedom, and what they found was Jim Crow. We're talking with historian Mia Bay about her new book called Traveling Black, A Story of Race and Resistance. Before we get back to our conversation, let me just play Jim Crow Blues, sung by blues singer Lead Belly.
Bunk Johnson told me to. This old Jim Crowisms did bad luck to me. I've been traveling from toe to toe. Everywhere I have been, I'll find some old Jim Crow. One thing, people, I want everybody to know. You're going to find some Jim Crow every place you go.
Let me read a comment from Jim. He says, can your guest talk about the sort of discrimination African-Americans faced on trolleys in Philadelphia, such as Frederick Douglass being told he couldn't ride inside a trolley and how that changed? Also, wasn't there an African-American woman who challenged discrimination on the trains to Westchester in the courts in the 1960s? Let me take the first part about the trolleys in Philadelphia and Frederick Douglass.
Jim Crow on the streetcars was really common in Philadelphia. Blacks were required to ride outside or sometimes not even allowed to ride them. This was a huge sort of conflict during the Civil War era. A lot of people got kicked off, and eventually people were able to successfully protest this. But definitely streetcars were a major site for conflicts. And sometimes there was sort of an idea that there would be a sort of separate streetcar that would be used by blacks, but this was something that even the streetcar companies didn't really want to do.
Yeah, I mean, that would be an expensive proposition, right?
Yes, exactly.
Unwieldy. You had mentioned the middle class, so I want to jump to the automobile, which I'm assuming for middle class blacks, that was a chance to get out on the road, but as we know, also facing a different kind of discrimination on the road.
Yeah, the automobile, for blacks who could afford it, seemed like it might provide an escape from Jim Crow. People were very early and enthusiastic adapters of the automobile. But over time, it would become clear that the automobile would also have its own kind of problems. I mean, we think of cars as this sort of private space, but you actually, to use a car, need to be able to stop at gas stations, hotels, get service, all these different things. And as an industry developed around the automobile of roadside accommodations and gas stations, prejudice again kind of emerges within one of the things that amazed me was that early on there were some gas stations that didn't serve black people.
So you couldn't fill up your tank.
And I actually had to kind of look into the history of the gas station and found that the gas station originated partially to sort of lure women into driving automobiles. When people first started driving cars, you just get your gas at the hardware store, but women didn't want to go into the hardware store.
Whole other history, right?
Yeah, they created this sort of nice homey space where these gas stations that advertised how clean and nice they were to lure in women. And then so some of them actually just didn't admit black people. And that would eventually change, but there were a lot of southern gas stations where there were no washrooms for black people, which people found infuriating. You could buy gas, but you couldn't use the restroom. If there was any kind of, restaurant, you could often be barred from using that as well. So once again, you had to kind of, if you're going to get on the road, try to figure out where the good gas station was, or if there was one.
And that's where the Green Book came in,
yeah.
And other guidebooks, which could tell you where you would be safe and could get some service.
Exactly. And actually, the Green Book originates in New York. It's, it's the brainchild of Victor Green, who lived in New York and was a mailman in New Jersey. And the first edition of it was just for the sort of New York area, because it was, again, sort of reporting, here's where you'll be welcome. Here's where you won't be turned away.
You have a quote from Langston Hughes. He's in New York City about just the difficulty of, it was Boxer Jack Johnson in mm-hmm. New York City. I mean, driving his car, he was well known at the time and having to deal with being stopped, right?
Yeah, well, he highlights the other problem that African Americans have long faced in cars and still faced. Cars expose you to the scrutiny of law enforcement, and blacks often got this in a very negative way. So Jack Johnson, who actually did speed and park on the sidewalk and do a variety of things to draw attention, he said it was for advertising purposes, but he got stopped for absolutely nothing in New York. So he said that he thought it was just for being a brunette in a blonde kind of town.
Yeah. Yeah. And this idea of a right of way, too, the idea that if you were at an intersection and you were a black person driving a car, you had to give the white drivers the right of way.
Well, that was another fascinating story that I kind of came across, is that in some parts of the Deep South, initially when cars are introduced, people really thought that the sort of rules of the road should be like designed around racial deference as everything else was in like places like Mississippi. So the idea was at a stop sign, the black person would stop and wait for the white people to go. This did not work for obvious reasons, four-way stops, you know, like we'd block one white person while you let another white person go. But some vestiges remained of in customs, like black people were not supposed to pass white people on dusty roads. Black men were supposed to be very careful about passing white women under any circumstances. So people were supposed to kind of use their cars in ways that recognized a certain kind of racial right of way.
And what about black chauffeurs for white people?
Well, black chauffeurs, initially when cars were introduced, there was some idea that blacks would not be able to drive cars, that this was a sort of too complicated machinery for African Americans. This is a time period, early 20th century, when there were a lot of arguments against blacks in factory work and stuff that were along this line. But eventually, especially with the labor shortage around World War I, they began to hire black chauffeurs, and then black chauffeurs became the norm. And some whites reported that they preferred them because you could make them do all sorts of other kinds of work, whereas the white chauffeur had been this kind of like auto mechanic who like dated your daughter and then ran away or something. So they were like, now we can just have black chauffeurs who are also the yard man.
And pay them less, probably,
and pay them less, exactly.
Than a white chauffeur. Yeah. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Mia Bay. She's a historian, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She's written several books, and she's got a brand new one. It's called Traveling Black, A Story of Race and Resistance. And again, if you want to join our conversation, of course, we'd love to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, let's go to buses. I mean, we began with trains. We talked about automobiles. Let's talk about buses. You said there was a time when there were Jim Crow jitneys, the idea that there would be, black bus companies run by blacks for black passengers.
Yeah, all buses originated from these jitney services, which were sort of large cars initially, where someone would just simply pick up other people. And for that reason, they kind of were racially segregated from the beginning. Whites would pick up other whites, and blacks began to create, you know, run jitneys themselves. They called them Jim Crow jitneys, and they welcomed them as an escape from streetcar segregation, because most of them were municipal to start with. So for a while, it seemed like you would have these black bus companies. And there were a couple that actually did last for decades. But most jitney services, both black and white, were regulated out of existence because, you know, the insurance, municipal laws, many cities didn't want them to compete with streetcars. So then you get bus companies, which initially often don't carry blacks at all until the sort of courts make it clear that if you are a common carrier, you actually have to pick up whoever wants to ride. And then that's when you begin to get this back of the bus seating.
There was a state or a county where blacks were not just in the back of the bus, but actually had to face out through the back of the bus. I mean, the idea we're both rolling our eyes at each other, but what was the thinking behind that?
It was an experiment in South Carolina, and it was really about creating like a totally separate space where whites didn't have to see blacks and the races didn't interact at all. So they experimented with, you know, turning the seats in the back around so blacks are facing the other way. But it caused such tremendous motion sickness that there was kind of a sustained campaign among African Americans to get rid of it. And I can't imagine even South Carolina whites wanted to be in a bus with everyone barfing in the back.
Which you would do if you were, facing the wrong way.
Yeah.
Well, we hopefully all know about Rosa Parks, but you write about someone, a woman named Irene Morgan, who predates Rosa Parks. Who was Irene Morgan?
Irene Morgan was a young mother. She worked in the defense industry. She was traveling in 1946 after having just had a miscarriage, and she just wanted a place to sit. And she was traveling at a time when it seemed like the Jim Crow laws on buses might on transportation might be breaking down, so she refused to move when she was asked to, and she got charged with breaking Virginia's segregation laws, and the NAACP would take her case, and she would eventually win. And what the courts kind of ruled is that it sort of interfered with interstate commerce to make someone sort of get up and get down and move around when they crossed from, you know, crossed from like Maryland into Virginia, you know, Washington and Virginia. It was just too much.
But she, I mean, she was dragged, as you describe it, or as she and others describe it, she was dragged off this bus.
She was dragged off the bus. She had a physical altercation with the bus driver summoned some guys to help her take her off. And this was not uncommon. This happened to women and men.
And men as well. But the idea of, I mean, just imagining someone being dragged off a bus because they happen to be the wrong color. Right?
Yeah. No, it's amazing.
Why don't we know about her, though? I mean, she her defiance and then, of course, her victory, I guess, in the courts.
Well, one reason we don't know about her victory is that because the southern states ignored it. The victory, I mean, they began to change some of the signage, which, you know, said that, you know, they had waiting rooms for interstate commerce versus local commerce. But they tried to get the carriers to have their own private laws. So things didn't change. So that's maybe one reason why we don't hear that much about it. Maybe we hear more about Rosa Parks because, you know, her standoff was the beginning of the end of certain kinds of segregation.
But as you say, or I guess others said about Irene Morgan, she really was the first freedom rider.
Well,
should we think of her that way?
No, actually, because I think the first freedom rider could be Elizabeth Jennings in New York City in 1830. I mean, this kind of refusal to put up with, you know, segregated transportation goes very far back. It actually goes back to stagecoaches. We could, you know, look at abolitionist David Ruggles, who had big fights when they tried to put him on the top of the stagecoach.
And is it unusual that there's so many women who were fighting some of these segregationist laws, especially on buses?
I don't think, well, women in the 19th century were more likely to win in the courts. So that was one reason why you had women doing it. But also, for men, I think it was even more dangerous. So we don't necessarily hear their stories because their stories didn't end up in court. They got literally physically thrown off trains. They were sometimes shot. It was a very dangerous sort of moment. And what you had with men, and this was particularly true in Montgomery, where Rosa Parks takes her stand, a lot of men in Montgomery had already stopped ever riding the bus because of the sort of how awful the bus drivers were and because any kind of challenge to them could be dangerous. So they walked if they could, or they drove.
Hopefully there's a more complicated picture of Rosa Parks. I mean, I think initially I remember when I was in school that she was this, you know, sweet seamstress on a bus. Mm-hmm. But in truth, she was so much more than that.
She was. She was, you know, she was an activist. She was a secretary for the NAACP. And it's interesting. I don't know why we have to kind of reduce her to someone who just sort of impulsively decides that she has this great idea of not, refusing to sit down at the back of the bus. Because, I mean, Montgomery had been planning some sort of boycott, the women of Montgomery, for a long time. And she knew that as well.
And was very much a part of that. And mm-hmm. and her ability, do you think it was timing then on her part? It was just somehow the confluence of events and some of these court decisions made that a more successful?
Yeah, it was timing and the fact that there was a whole bunch of people in Montgomery, mostly women who had been really thinking about doing this for a long time, who sprang into action. They, you know, had mimeograph machines. They had the notices out. They did everything you needed to do. But I think, you know, it was also Rosa Parks had encountered that bus driver before. He had been very rude to her before. So it was a long time coming for her. She was just not going to put up with it anymore.
And this idea of a boycott had a huge impact, right?
It had a huge impact, yes.
Financially for...
Well, that was what Montgomery really felt like they could, the Montgomery Improvement Association thought that they could drive the, you know, bankrupt the bus company, which they could, but then the state kind of came in and helped it.
And after that, the laws were changed?
Yes, after that, the laws were changed, and that was sort of the beginning of, you know, there was a successful court case in which it was ruled that the buses could not be segregated, even these municipal buses.
And did that have a national impact, or was it?
No, it was sort of piecemeal. I mean, that was the other thing about transportation is that, you know, you change something one place, and then some other places would change, but other places wouldn't. There was kind of a resistance. So that's one of the reasons why you have to ultimately have the Freedom Rides and really sort of push the issue on a national level.
And the Freedom Rides, which I do want to talk about after our break, which is coming up, I mean, really put a spotlight on the dangerousness of challenging some of these transportation laws.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, the Freedom Rides are most famous for that. You've probably seen the photograph of the bus that was bombed outside Anniston. But they, you know, the Freedom Riders were beat in a couple of different bus stations. They were threatened. The church that they ended up gathering in at one point had, like, smoke bombs thrown into it. So it was a real standoff because you had, in the South at that time, politicians who were really making their careers on sort of insisting on maintaining segregation.
Mm. Well, let's take that short break and then we'll pick up on that story. And again, Mia Bay is our guest on Radio Times today. She's a historian. She teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, professor there. She's written several books and we're talking about her new one. It's called Traveling Black, A Story of Race and Resistance. And again, you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always pick up the phone. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with University of Pennsylvania historian Mia Bay about this little told history of civil rights, about how activists fought for equality on the road through the courts, also through protests in defiance of the laws. And again, it's what she writes about in her new book called Traveling Black. Let me play one more song. This is Joshua White singing Uncle Sam Says. It's a Jim Crow song on the Keynote record album Southern Exposure, recorded back in 1941.
Well, airplanes flying across the land and the sea. Everybody flying them but a Negro like me. Uncle Sam says, your place is on the ground. When I fly my airplanes, don't want no Negro round. The same thing for the Navy when ships go to sea. All they got is a mess boy's job for me, Uncle Sam says. Keep on your apron, son. You know I ain't gonna let you shoot my big Navy gun. Got my long government letters, my time to go. When I got to the army, found the same old Jim Crow. Uncle Sam says, two camps for black and white. But when trouble starts, we'll all be in that same big fight.
And again, Joshua White singing Uncle Sam Says. Well, let me segue. You do chapter by chapter looking at various mm-hmm. forms of public transit, traveling by plane. This, of course, takes us in well into the 20th century. How were black passengers treated on airplanes?
Well, Black passengers were initially sometimes not allowed to travel on airplanes at all. Again, there was a sort of moment where they sort of debated whether they were common carriers, but by the 1930s, they were beginning to allow them. But then it was very hard to dig and kind of find this stuff. There were very few black plane passengers, but there is evidence that there was some early segregation. In particular, there are a lot of reports that initially they're often put in the front seat of the plane.
Which is the prize seat now,
which is the
right?
prize seat now.
So you get on and off quickly.
Yeah, but I had to kind of poke around to try to figure out why that would have been. But it turns out that on propeller planes that they used to use, the front seat was right by the propeller. The entrance was actually at the back, and it was tremendously noisy, and there were a lot of sparks. So that was why this was sort of an undesirable single seat, which they would often assign black passengers to. When the plane designs changed to something more familiar than we have now, there began to be a practice where they would try to sit black passengers together, because usually they'd only have, you know, a maximum of maybe two black passengers on a given plane ride, and they would try to make sure they were all in the same row.
Wow. And I guess that would be sort of just looking at people and saying, you go here, you go there?
Well, no. I mean, this is sort of why it became, they would assign people according to their zip code, their neighborhoods, their voice on the phone, if they made the booking on the phone. And if none of that worked, the stewardesses might come and simply ask people to move. So especially during the Second World War, when sometimes you'd have black and white soldiers traveling together and they'd ask the black one to move, this is sort of when it became totally clear what this was.
You quote Langston Hughes, who would travel, and he talked about seat number one. This was the one near the propeller.
Yes.
But he did say he thought it was actually not a bad seat, right?
Yeah, no, he liked seat number one because you got a really good view, and, you're right in the front. But most other people did not seem to agree, or just, you know, Horace Caton, who was another black writer, when he finally realized that he was getting seat number one every time, it just sort of made him furious. It wasn't even whether he liked it or didn't like it. He just didn't like being segregated.
You mentioned soldiers, and I just wonder how much World War II and post-World War II just changed these notions and even the laws of segregation after that war.
Well, both wars put a tremendous stress on the transportation system, which made segregation exponentially worse, especially in the South, because in the South it was customary that if whites got on the bus first, and if there were no seats by the time the whites had filled up the bus, then blacks didn't get on the bus at all. So you began to have these stories of blacks waiting for 2 days to get a bus. The Jim Crow cars become kind of difficult to find. They put less of them on the trains. There's just not enough transportation. And then black soldiers traveling, you know, back and forth from like leave would have to get back to their bases. And if they couldn't get back, they could be reported as AWOL. So it was kind of a crisis for many black people. And there was beginning to be more white impatience with it. White soldiers didn't always see why, you know, other soldiers that they knew couldn't, you know, sit on the train or eat in the dining car on the train. So there was some new pressures on it, which blacks hoped would lead to making it break down. There's also during this time period real black resistance to segregation. There was what was called the Double Victory Campaign, where African Americans kind of committed to the war only on the idea that they would also fight segregation at home.
Which is a good segue to the Freedom Riders. And, mm-hmm. and these were blacks, but also and whites who were trying to defy some of these public transportation segregation laws as it applied to buses.
Yeah, and they built on an earlier freedom ride called the Journey of Reconciliation, which actually occurs right after World War II. And it is actually led by these members of CORE, which is a sort of pacifist racial equality organization. And they think that segregation is beginning to break down, and they think they can sort of try to challenge it through traveling through the Upper South on the bus. you know, they have sort of mixed results, but it's not explosive. But in 1960, Kaur returns to this in 1961 and decides to really take it down to the Deep South, which they had avoided the last time. And they have recent Supreme Court rulings really saying that it is illegal to segregate people on interstate transportation or in, you know, in railroad stations and bus stations. And they want to sort of push this new, because all these law legal changes have been coming in favor of desegregation, but a lot of states have not been cooperating, or they've been finding kind of workarounds where they do it by police order, or they make it the private company's policy. And the Freedom Riders challenge this, and it becomes explosive in Alabama, because there you have a variety of political figures who are really, you know, sort of making a stand on segregation. And they sort of, they allow mobs to gather and beat up the Freedom Riders. They create a national and sort of international crisis, because the Kennedy administration at this point is very sort of embarrassed by these pictures of buses being bombed, riders being beaten up, reporters being beaten up. You know, this is a time when they're worried about, it's in the middle of the Cold War. They're worried about what kind of impression this is going to give, especially to this sort of newly independent African states who they're trying to get sort of support for democracy from.
You quote a lawyer, Dovi Johnson Rountree, in her autobiography talking about, and there's a famous or infamous picture of one of these buses on fire. Mm-hmm. And she says, it was a shame. The whole world looked and was horrified at the image of the Freedom Bus bursting into flames on a highway outside a little Alabama town called Anniston, May 14th, 1961. And the whole world, at least the world that was reached by television, saw the young men and women, black and white, stepping out to bus platforms in Birmingham and being met by mobs of cursing Klansmen armed with clubs and chains, being beaten and bloodied long before they even reached restaurants and soda fountains that they were bent on integrating. I think if anyone has seen those images of you know, Bull Connor, and it's all sort of part of a mosaic about what was happening at that time.
Yeah, and it, you know, it made it, you know, it the Freedom Rides drew new participants. It inspired a sort of generation of college students to commit to racial justice, and it just wasn't tenable, particularly at this particular time.
But this idea of shame, I mean, that this was the shame of the country, and there
the
it was.
The shame of the country,
for
yes.
For the world to see.
Yeah. No, it's this is also a moment where you all of a sudden have this mass media where this goes out across the world. There's television. There's, you know, these images are really vivid, and they really make an impact, and they capture people's imagination.
And the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that's really pivotal, right?
Yeah, it's another pivotal moment where you really have some of these issues addressed fair squarely, to sort of, especially when it comes to things like the desegregation of restaurants and hotels. The Civil Rights Act takes this up as, again, as interstate transportation, because they decide that this is the way to go. And, you know, you can no longer have those colored signs. You can no longer keep black people out of certain hotels, restaurants, anything like that, at least not legally. And it's also enforced. They actually do send, you know, Justice Department officials, FBI agents, to kind of investigate where people do not desegregate and make sure that they actually do.
And we should recognize the work of Thurgood Marshall, the ACLU. I mean, this was their fight.
Was their fight. I mean, the NAACP fights for years on this and provides support for other people who are fighting it. Yeah, it's a long, long struggle that kind of illustrates how difficult social change is and how long it takes, which in ways that we should probably think about today, because sometimes things seem impossible. And this fight, you know, went from like from the antebellum era to 1964 to finally secure these basic civil rights.
Almost 100 years,
yeah.
Right. Quoting Thurgood Marshall, and this is where he's talking about segregation on trains. He says, Negroes are not permitted to eat until it's time for the crew to eat, and then are required to eat behind very heavy curtains as if they were convicts or lepers or alien enemies rather than full American citizens.
Yeah, that was another infuriating thing, that the dining cars were something where blacks had to be sort of put, you know, put out of sight and also not permitted to use as long as whites actually needed it. And it was humiliating. Martin Luther King said that the first time he had that experience, he felt like a curtain had been put down on his soul, like it was just, you know, utterly humiliating.
But there was an actual curtain, right?
There was an actual curtain. I mean, they kept changing the way they did it, but the curtain existed for a while, as did, on some trains, the idea that blacks simply couldn't use the dining car. The curtain was sort of a compromise on that original idea.
I read that one of the things that got you thinking about this was Hurricane Katrina and the fact that many blacks living in New Orleans couldn't get out because there was no transportation out of the city.
Yeah, no, as I was sort of beginning to work on this book, Hurricane Katrina happened and it just captured my imagination, just the pictures of blacks stranded in the Superdome. And I wrote an essay about sort of why African Americans could not leave New Orleans, which had all to do with everything to do with the way that we live in a kind of car culture today. And nothing was really prepared for people who couldn't get in their own car to get out of New Orleans. There was no thought about that. And there's also all these sort of other ways in which people don't have cars, are not really well served by the state today.
But there's a whole other part of this narrative having to do with stopping black drivers because their taillight is out and altercations with the police and even, you know, death by police.
Yeah, and that to me is sort of the tragic coda to this story, because in many ways the sort of overcoming the sort of legal segregation of transportation is a sort of magnificent battle that ends well, but it's a Pyrrhic victory, because with the desegregation of buses and trains, they also sort of disappear. I mean, we have far fewer inner-city buses than we used to have.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah. And we also don't have very many trains anymore. We have Amtrak, which is just a vestige of the sort of incredible network of trains that used to move people across the country. And the nation as a whole has moved towards cars. The states and federal government put their money into roads. And this remains kind of inequitable because people have differential access to cars according to their finances and where they live. But there is also this sort of new level of racial profiling. Black drivers have always been subject to legal scrutiny, but with the war on drugs in the 1980s and beyond, they've started to sort of, that's when you start to get the profiling where police just stop people at random, you know, for minor infractions that they didn't used to stop people for. This is also when you first get the phrase driving while black, which, you know, did not exist before that. And it was really about the way these sort of random, these traffic stops targeted black and brown drivers, and they still do. And, you know, those have made, you know, the idea of an open road for African Americans also a sort of ideal that is still not realized. African Americans sort of constantly worry about being stopped by the police.
We're almost out of time, so an unfair question, but you are a historian. But as you look, as we deal with this right now, do you have some degree of optimism that as a country, maybe it'll take another 100 years to be able to address some of this inequity on the road?
I have some degree, at least in the sense that people are paying attention to it. There's sort of a widespread acknowledgement that it exists. There's discussions of police reform. There are many organizations sort of working on this issue. But I also realize it's very difficult, and I'm a little horrified to realize it might take as long as the previous struggle.
Well, we have to leave it there. Mia Bay, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Her book is called Traveling Black, A Story of Race and Resistance. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Kelsey Hansen, and Paige Murray Bessler. This is Freedom Highway, sung by the Staple Singers off their 1965 album, Freedom Highway. This was the title song written for the 1965 march from Selma to Montgomery.